Welcome to Intersection on KBIA. I'm Janet Saidi. The city of Columbia has seen a few dramatic personnel changes in the past few weeks, beginning with the resignation of city manager Mike Mathis in November, followed by the resignation of police chief Ken Burton, and most recently the elimination of the position of deputy city manager. Burton had faced controversies throughout his tenure over his handling of racial bias and police stops data, along with high turnover and low morale in the department, and his commitment or lack of it to community policing. All of this raises the question, what just happened? And what is happening next for the city of Columbia? We've brought in some professional front row observers to help us analyze what we can learn from these recent events and what we can take with us going forward. Andrea Benjamin is an MU professor of political science who researches race and politics and local elections. She's also an avid watcher and new voter in Columbia since moving here a year ago. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
Catherine Reed is a journalism professor and faculty editor at the Columbia Missourian, where she oversees coverage on the beats of healthcare and public safety. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks, Janet.
Rudy Keller is a longtime state government and politics reporter and serves as the news editor at the Columbia Tribune. Welcome, Rudy.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm great. So thanks to all of you for joining. There's been a lot of changes. So my first question is just, what is going on? How much of this specifically do you see as being internal politics going on with the city? And how much of it was brought about by community controversies and forces at work within the community?
That's a hard question to answer because, as we now know, there were things going on behind closed doors. There wasn't a high degree of transparency in some of the decision making. After the city manager resigned, there were some disclosures about ongoing issues between the city manager and city council that citizens just didn't know about. So there's like a tip of an iceberg kind of thing. There were parts of both the city manager's departure and the police chief's departure, which I think are related, that were sort of submerged. We didn't really get to see them.
One of the things that occurs in a city government like the way Columbia is structured is that people like a city manager kind of wear out their welcome over time, unless they are just a great politician and a great administrator. Then they antagonize people, and Mike Mathis was the first person we had a city manager who had been hired from outside of Columbia in 30 years. And so he was here for 7 years, which was a nice long tenure. And if he had left on his own to take a job in a larger city, kind of climbing the ladder the way many of these professionals do in that kind of a role, we might have sent him off with a pat on the back. Nice job. You got our parks tax redone. We got nice parks. And it would have all occurred before these most recent big controversies. So part of it is he wore out his welcome. Part of it is the council saw resistance to things that they wanted to do. And that's the city manager's job, is to take the policies created by the council and execute them to the best of his ability. It's not to decide that the policy decisions of the council are wrong. So I think that had added to the tension. If he had stayed 5 years and gone on, we might have been patting him on the back as he left.
Okay. I want to dig into a little bit of these issues that you're both sort of mentioning. Andrea, first, though, as someone who researches city governments and how they're put together and how they work, what's been your observation as an engaged citizen coming into Columbia and watching this?
Sure. In some ways, I agree with Catherine and Rudy that it sort of seems like politics as usual, except a couple things, and maybe these are only noticeable to sort of an astute observer, right? So one thing is to your point, yes, if he had just gotten a new job, we might have been patting him on the back. But in my 1 year here, I attend city council meetings, or at least watch them. And there were several moments, as this sort of expert observer, that I was like, this council doesn't trust this manager and his staff. And I knew that various just different moments, because so many things are typically hashed out in council work session. so that when we see them on Monday night, there's some room for public comment. We might see something get tabled, but typically things are going to move forward in a very known way. And several times things didn't go that way. And so that already lets me know that there's a problem. And you brought up a really good point. That's just something I'm really interested in, which is voters and voter turnout, right? And as a voter, right, we don't get that much say in it, except that we get to elect the mayor and council that hires and fires the city manager. And so what seems important to me as we move forward is, should we hire a manager before we have these elections in April? My expert opinion is no, right? Because we will end up in the same situation where if there's high turnover, guess what? Now we have a city manager who's been hired again under a council that didn't select him or her. And so I think that maybe there is some benefit in waiting, although maybe that's not what people want to hear.
I don't think that the timeline is going to allow the council to hire someone
right
before the April election. We will have in that April election, it's looking like it's only going to be the mayor's race.
That's competitive.
And it's going to be a pretty high profile race because of the nature of the challenger to
right
the mayor.
Right.
Someone who's been in public office and held various public offices dating all the way back to 1978. And
right,
really astute politician.
Chris Kelly.
Yeah, Chris Kelly. Right. And so we will have an opportunity as voters to put a verdict on that. I do agree with you about the distrust that was evident. The idea that, the city manager was found to have knowingly violated the Sunshine Law by withholding documents from the
right
police union, who has been a big supporter of the mayor.
Right.
So the mayor has the police union has the ear of the mayor, and they have disliked and distrusted Mathis. That has bled into the council, but Mathis did things that did not prove that he was trustworthy, violating the Sunshine Law. These kinds of things, when the council is going one way and the manager is going another, are destined to bring these kinds of results, it would seem. And you know more about city government and how often that kind of thing occurs than I do, Andrea.
How usual is that, Andrea?
I mean, I think that, you know, there is sort of a timeline, right, that a city manager will work for a certain amount of time. I've seen cities where that relationship has gone longer and it's been fine, and other places where it's shorter. Then my hope, right, knowing that it is true, right, the timeline doesn't look feasible to hire a manager before April. My hope then is that for the mayor's race, we hear a lot about what type of the vision for the city from each candidate. And so that then again, we as residents and voters, as we make our decision, when we cast that ballot, we're really saying, I agree with your vision of the city. And I trust that with you leading the process, we're going to end up with a manager that we all agree on, we have a mandate on, and that there's a better working relationship and more trust, right? So I think that's what's really, I hope we hear these things. And we're not going to hear them from the council race, as it doesn't seem competitive at all.
But you said it as an observer that you had seen evidence that the council didn't trust the manager, and I was wondering what if you can recall what particular moment triggered that thought.
Yeah, I was actually telling Janet about it yesterday. So as part of my teaching, when I teach urban politics, we attend city council meetings. So that was the last meeting. Of course, the students had procrastinated. We're all at the meeting in April when they want to buy this plot of land for trash. Now, the key question, I don't remember who asked it, someone said, what's the valuation on the land? That is, I'm going to buy this land for $10, is it worth $10? Is it worth $12? Is it worth $2? And the manager, whoever was representing the staff, said, I don't know. And that was the moment I saw, we have a problem here. Because again, this would have normally been worked out in a work session. And if the council or someone, the mayor, had that question, they would have already done the research. Thank you for that question. We had the land valued. It was valued at $10 billion. So getting it for $600,000, it's a steal, right? But they didn't know. And so that let me know there's a problem. Now, I'd already seen a couple things, but that to me was the most egregious, where I said, oh, we have a problem here.
You're listening to Intersection on KBIA. I'm Janet Saidi. We're talking about recent changes in Columbia, staffing changes with the departure of the city's city manager and police chief. And we're digging into what's behind those changes and what it all means for the city going forward. I'm talking with MU professor Andrea Benjamin, Columbia Missourian faculty editor Catherine Reed, and Columbia Tribune news editor Rudy Keller. So as we were saying, there's a lot up in the air right now. With the city, we've got elections coming up, then they'll likely be looking at a city manager and then a police chief. Based on everything we've seen, what are the issues that people in Colombia are going to want to bring to the forefront? What are going to be the issues that people are talking about? What are the issues you're watching, Catherine?
Community policing, for sure. I mean, that's been placed so firmly on the agenda by Race Matters Friends and by actual police officers with experience in the community outreach unit, who I think were far more persuaded by the value of community policing than our recently departed police chief was. So I expect that that will continue to be an issue that people will talk about.
Okay. Rudy, Andrea?
I think that the finances of the city, it goes back to this, back to community policing in a way, but the city has been struggling to find money for things like additional officers, raising the pay of office of police and firefighters because they need to keep them. The interesting thing about John Glasscock, our interim city manager, is that he has stepped up and he cut back on the budget of the city manager's office. I get the sense that this is not going to be the first administrative position on the chopping block as he goes through. It's kind of interesting that someone with an interim in his title is doing these kinds of things, but you know, he says his job is to get the city in good shape for the next manager to come in and then start bringing programs or ideas that can then be funded. It will be very interesting to see how this plays out over the next 6 months, what other things that John Glasscock does, but the city's finances are not bad. We have a good credit rating. All our bills are paid. We have our parks are kept up. The paychecks for the police all cash, but the community wants more out of city government and more. I get the feeling that no matter what we do, we're going to get more officers as we move to community policing.
Okay. Andrea, what would be on your radar?
Yeah, I mean, I think both, you know, this notion of community policing, and again, I think sort of going back to what I study, I think the most sort of amazing thing about Colombia is that sort of these outside organizations exist to agitate. And from a political science standpoint, what we usually expect to happen is, you know, a group A is dissatisfied and they run a candidate. And what we're seeing here is there has not been a Race Matters Friends candidate. In fact, they have decided that the best way to implement change and to demand change is to engage with this process as just an organization, but that they're making these demands on the council. And we see some of these sort of, some of the staffing issues are sort of a result of that. Even sort of this call for community policing sort of seems to come from them. And I think, you know, again, just from a social science research standpoint, I find this extremely fascinating. I think the question of the finances is interesting, right? So I was going through the police report or the report that police
Sergeant Robert Cox, that
he made. And, you know, I sort of see this mention that like he did that, he crunched the numbers. And in fact, if we want to fully fund our police department, it's just $250 per person or per household in taxes, which sounds like nothing to me. That's just me saying, and I'm saying that from a privileged place of my own finances. But that's like me saying this year, I just won't go out and get coffee one day. Kudos to me. Right. But the fact, again, going back to this sort of this relationship, the fact that the council didn't even want to ask us to pay $250 more a year to support this plan, again, says that there's a problem with trust and communication. Because in another report, maybe if it had been better spelled out, the report makes a lot of sort of mentions of comparable cities, but provides not even anecdotal or data evidence about a place that has been successful adding $250 a year to taxes, right? And so there's these pieces, again, that are just missing where, again, from the outside, I'm like, oh, I can pay $250 a year. I would enjoy community policing for $250 a year, but the fact that the council doesn't even trust them to collect $250 a year from us and use it wisely, we have a problem.
One of the problems with Sergeant Fox's report, and over the weekend as I was talking with some council members, is that they're just going to toss it out and start over.
Golly.
Because the recommendations that it includes, the ideas for change in the police department are all wrapped in some pretty serious accusations of anti-police bias, even against the journalism school, that the journalism school teaches reporters to be anti-police, that marijuana trade in town is the main cause of violent crime, and not other drug gangs, or not harder drugs, but the marijuana trade. And so these statements that just fly in the face sometimes of what we know about, you know, like within the media, we thought that was weird when we saw that, because 95% of reporting that is about police activity is basically reporting what they think they found from their point of view.
Right.
And so the other 5% is when we get a chance to bring up what is going on in the police department, what is going wrong in their investigative methods. We don't go looking for those stories, but we don't shy away from them either. And that's where, you know, but how that turns into anti-police bias is only in the minds of people who can't see that the police ever do anything wrong.
Catherine, what's your take on that report and on this issue of how we teach reporting on the police and what came out of that report?
Right. The report felt to me as if it were doomed from the start, because it felt wrapped in a bias. And so specifically to what Rudy was talking about this anti-police bias, it's just absolutely inaccurate. I think that, you know, one of the things that I teach is just respect for all people in the reporting process. And I talk about the difficulty of what police do, but I also talk about the history of the relationship between the police and the policed, and in Columbia, Missouri, and the importance of understanding that relationship. It stays with communities for a very long time, through generations, a lack of trust, which affects the police, the police's authority over communities. So that relationship can be really fraught, and we have to understand that as journalists. That's not the same as teaching disrespect, though. That's just teaching sort of cultural and historical understanding, which I think is crucial no matter what you cover. But I do want to get back to your question about the report. You know, it felt to me reading it as if it was an argument for hiring more police officers above all else. And the argument had been made before. It's been made continually. We cannot do community policing without more police officers. And the argument of Race Matters Friends, the counter argument has been, let's start doing community policing and expand from there. And then we will get behind your efforts to hire more police officers.
You're listening to Intersection on KBIA. I'm Janet Saidi, talking with MU Professor Andrea Benjamin, Columbia Missourian Faculty Editor Catherine Reed, and Columbia Tribune News Editor Rudy Keller. You can see more on all of these issues and on this conversation at kbia.org. So let's dig in a little bit more to community policing. What was missing, if anything, from Burton's dialogue on community policing? We have examples nationally of community policing efforts that do blatantly name a national problem in racial profiling, especially the Obama administration task force report on community policing in the 21st century, which looked at policing in a post-Ferguson world. Mm-hmm. There's the No Violence Alliance in Kansas City. Is there potential and momentum and even data, speaking of data, that Burton was not able to tap into with this conversation?
You know what strikes me? It's not so much what was missing. It was what he asserted in that discussion about community policing. And it was that he knew what it was and that other people did not. And that people were talking about community policing who, he said, didn't understand anything about it. What really struck me about his response when we talked about it was arrogance, that he was taking the position that he was the expert on it. And there was some anger there in that discussion. And so anger and frustration, right? So what struck me was that he didn't feel that people had the right to talk about community policing with any authority if they weren't police. I thought we're in trouble then as a community, because there are people
in the community talking about it and who are able to talk about it with some authority. And we had written at the Missourian a really big piece on community policing as it has been used in other communities like Gainesville, Florida, and in Kansas City, Missouri. And we just really looked at how it went there, the good, the bad, the difficult. So it was sort of like a moment where I thought the police chief has given up on his community and his community's ability to make decisions for itself. So I was very aware in that Q&A that there was a power struggle going on. He didn't want me using the word impasse. He was really like, you know, please don't call it an impasse, but it really was. And so I think that one of the things we're seeing in Columbia, you know, to get back to the sort of the bigger picture, though, is a power struggle. People have asserted themselves as citizens should and as citizens do in healthy communities. And I saw a lot of backlash to that.
How tall of an order is it to expect a police chief and a police department officers to be able to be transparent about their problems, their biases, and to be able to accept community input and on getting better, and maybe when they're not ready yet, but the community's ready? Is this happening in places like Gainesville and Kansas City and other places?
The term community policing, right? The thing that struck me as you were talking is, so only the police can know about, the community can't know about community policing, right? I think that that's sort of an unfortunate sort of standpoint. I mean, I think, right, so one of the things that we think about, you know, as we sort of do the research, right, is that police organizations have culture, right? And so that's really sort of the hardest barrier, right, is that a new chief can come in and want to do certain things, but that might not work out the way people thought, right? And so the best example I have just to sort of give, so I just recently moved here from Durham, and, you know, this book I'm working on is very Durham heavy, but I had a colleague previously at UNC, Frank Baumgartner, who was sort of one of these first people to use all the state of North Carolina's billion point data set about traffic stops with the state police. And, you know, he'd gone around the state and presented these data, and different communities responded differently. So Durham was very upset. They brought in experts to say, you use the data wrong, you don't know how to do your statistics. But in Fayetteville, the police chief there, who retired, you know, sort of, I thought about him when you were talking about what if someone does something really good. When he left, when he retired last summer, it was like people were devastated. So they got the same data from Frank. Hey, there's a bias in your stops. If you're Black, you're like 9 times more likely to be stopped. If you're Latino, you're like 11 times more likely, right? He just presents the data. It sounds very much like the Columbia data, although it's a little bit higher, right? And so what happens in both places, the council in both cities end up saying, let's get written consent for traffic stops. And what we see in Fayetteville is immediately a decrease in traffic stops and searches, and also no increase in probable cause searches, which is the back door. When someone doesn't want to give consent, you say, oh, I saw something, probable cause, I'm still going to search you. And what they saw in Durham was just still an increase in probable cause searches, right? So we see a culture, right, that in one place the police chief said, you know what, I'm going to trust this data. I believe that there's a bias. What can I do? And so they saw just a decrease in searches and no use of probable cause. So then the council had to come through and sort of try to clean that up in a city like Durham, right? So in those cases, it is the culture, but culture is hard to change, right?
Yes,
so
right.
It is very much. And so when I was reading things like, people become police officers because they want action. I don't know what that means, but that's very
Chief Burton saying that.
That was very right, because to my mind, when you're 5 and you want to be a police officer, well, I want to help people.
I mean, it's a hard thing to do, right?
It's a hard job.
Yeah, I want to say two things, because out of fairness to the former chief, one, I know he started with the idea in mind to change the culture of the Columbia Police Department.
Right.
He really did. He started out with a sort of a very high energy, I've got this, I think I know what I need to do here. And I saw some things happen. And I don't know, maybe Rudy's got a different take on this, but I think that he took it very hard that when he attempted to be transparent in the Rob Sanders incident, when he released the video that showed Rob Sanders pushing a prisoner in a police holding cell against the wall hard enough to break a vertebra, and the backlash by his officers in the department was so intense. He took so much heat for that. I think that was the beginning of his sort of embattled period.
Right.
That's when it became this question of, I'm either with my guys or I'm against my guys. Yeah. That's what it looked like to me, that it was hard for him to find a balance between being sensitive to the community and being as transparent as possible and seeming to support rank and file officers. I think that had a huge impact on him and his standing both within the department and how he behaved going forward.
What do you all want to see going forward now?
With the new police chief, we're going to want, and it's clear to me this is what the council is going to want the new manager to do, is hire someone who recognizes that community policing is an attitude in the department. It is not a numbers game.
Okay.
I would say transparency above all. And one of the things that the public probably doesn't know is that the media, the news media in Columbia, deal with sort of almost a peephole into the news via the police department. They are very slow, and they're blaming it on their new records management system that requires a 72-hour approval process for an incident report before anyone can talk to the news media about it. So, you know, I mean, overall, I am hopeful that the new city manager and the new police chief will not just talk about transparency, but will make it a part of their daily routine and their decision making. So, I mean, the Mayor Treese has said that he values transparency. And I hope that that's true and that that will be reflected in the big hires that are about to be made.
Okay.
Yeah, I will just echo what Catherine and Rudy said. I mean, I think transparency is important, but I also hope that, you know, for those of us that are listening sort of in the community and we think about what do we want, I hope that we choose to engage with the forums, with opportunities to meet with candidates, both for city council and mayor, because, again, this is our only accountability mechanism. We only elect the council and the mayor, and it's their job to hire and fire the manager, who then hires and fires the chief. So this is our only way to hold anyone accountable. And so I hope that the turnout rates that we saw in the past are higher, mm-hmm. because otherwise the real question is, what mandate do these people have when they're running on non-competitive elections or turnout is 10-15%?
Right.
That's not enough. So register to vote.
Okay. And on that note, Andrea, Rudy, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us at Intersection. And thank you for listening to Intersection. Intersection is produced at KBIA by the news team, Nathan Lawrence, Rebecca Smith, Sebastian Martinez, Valdivia, Chris Husted, our news director, Ryan Femuliner, and directing today's show is Mark Johnson. You can see more on this conversation at kbia.org, including a timeline of Chief Ken Burton's tenure in the City of Columbia. I'm Janet Saidi. Thanks for listening.